Welcome to the Just Raise podcast. This episode is one of the first shows I ever recorded for the podcast with Phil Libin, the founder and CEO of I wasn't as good a host as I am now, but Phil is a fantastic guest. And about 2 weeks after this episode was recorded, he announced a $30 million raise from Sequoia. And less than a year later, raised another $100 million from the SoftBank Vision Fund. It's one of my favorite conversations, so I wanted to share it with all of you, most of whom probably haven't heard it yet. So I hope you enjoy this conversation with Phil Libin at Today on the podcast, we have Phil Libin, former founder and CEO of Evernote, founder of the stellar All Turtles design firm, and now the founder and CEO of We talk about how he designs product, his recent venture raise from Sequoia, and how plans to rid the world of PowerPoint. This is Just Raised. Listeners, some of you may already know our guest, Phil Libin. Prior to starting he was the founder and CEO of Evernote. After that, he started investing in startups as an MD at General Catalyst and started All Turtles, a product design firm. He's also the frequent host of the fantastic All Turtles podcast. Phil started in April 2020 and just raised $4.5 million from Sequoia in July. Phil, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Phil, tell us a little bit about
Is a product to help you level up your video performances. I think basically all of us are, at least most of us are stuck at home working over video, and it was just kind of boring and dreary and sometimes ineffective, and we wanted to make it better. So this is a way to just inject some personality into any time you'd have to do something on video.
Yeah. So tell us, how does it work for all of our listeners out there who haven't seen the demo yet, which I highly recommend if you haven't?
Well, basically, the two-second pitch, I guess, is that it's like instant weekend update. It lets you kind of live out your vicarious John Oliver fantasies, or Saturday Night Live fantasies. Make it really easy to do this person behind the news desk with a screen over their shoulder. You can present, you can change slides, you can talk. That's kind of the basics of it. But then from there, there's lots more stuff that you can do. So you can control your environment. You can fly around the set. You can have multiple people presenting at the same time. You can make interactive recordings. We're just trying to reimagine what video is going to be like over the next few years as more and more we just have to do stuff on video. We have to interact with big parts of the world through our video cameras.
Yeah, the feature set is fascinating. It feels like everything you might want Zoom to do or wouldn't imagine that you'd want Zoom to do. You describe the product as video native, which I think is really interesting because it's not about getting as close to in-person meetings as you can, which feels like what Zoom is for. You turn it on and it just works. Instead, it's doing things like shrinking you down to the corner of the screen so you can see a graph behind you, or clicking play on a recording of yourself in the middle of a presentation where you can click through slides, but also go back and actually watch someone present it to you. I'm curious, how do you think about building products native to video versus building products that are aiming to replace what we used to do?
Yeah, I think this is a really important question. You know, like remember, actually, if you go all the way back and you watch like really, really, really early films, you know, like some of the first films ever made, like in the teen, like the 19 teens and the 1920s, right at the beginning of the industry, they're really weird, right? Because basically people invented the, you know, movie cameras, you know, film cameras, but they hadn't really invented anything else. And so they just took what they knew, which was basically like theater. So they knew, like, you know, people on a stage performing a play, and they just filmed it. So like a lot of the early movies are, they're just kind of trying to recreate the previous reality that the people were familiar with, which were plays, and they just tried to put them on film. And they just look really strange right now. You know, they hadn't invented multiple cameras, and they hadn't invented, you know, cutting away, close-ups, or any of that stuff. But like when you, sometimes you watch movies from the, you know, from the 20s, and you know, even when two people are talking, they have to sort of stand side by side together so they can both be on the camera at the same time, because they just haven't figured out that, you know, that should be a two camera shot and so on. And then, you know, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and as the industry developed, you had directors that were more native to this. It didn't occur to them to try to recreate stage plays. They invented the new vocabulary of what you could do with this new medium, with film. And you see that all the time. Whenever there's like a sharp technological change, whether there's like a new paradigm, a lot of the first generation of stuff in that paradigm is just trying to recreate the old world in the new reality. We saw this very strongly at Evernote. You know, when we started Evernote, it was 2007, you know, 2008. It was really the start of like the smartphone era. And a lot of the very first smartphone apps were, you know, existing companies, you know, Microsoft and others trying to just make smaller versions of their desktop apps. Like they knew what an app, you know, what Excel should be like on the desktop. So they're like, okay, how do we just make it smaller so that it fits on the screen? And it really wasn't until the first native generation of software that was like made after the smartphone revolution had already started, like Evernote, like, you know, Uber, like Dropbox, that we're like, we weren't trying to recreate anything. We're trying to imagine what you can do with the new technology. And I think video is in exactly the same place right now. So there's been this very sharp paradigm change, you know, triggered by the pandemic, but, you know, would have happened anyway. And the first attempt at a lot of these products are basically just trying to recapture the world that we used to have. It used to be, you know, there's a lot of people saying, man, you know, oh, my sales team isn't really as efficient, as effective as they used to be because, you know, I used to have salespeople flying around the country and taking clients out to dinner, and now they can't do that. So we have to do it over video. And selling stuff over video it's not as good as it used to be selling in person, but like maybe if we get better microphones, we can make it kind of almost as good. So there's a lot of this attempt to like recreate the old world. And I think like every time in the past, like that's a very understandable first reaction, but it's not what's going to succeed. What's going to succeed are like the native attempts when you give up trying to recreate what used to be and you just say, okay, well, what's actually possible now? What can we make to make the experience ridiculously better than it ever was before, not almost as good? So I think adapting that kind of thinking is the design challenge of our time.
That's fascinating. It's really interesting. You're building the panning and tracking shots of the future of video.
Yeah, I think so. And not to keep it in a video example, I think, oh, like we're also building the swipe left and swipe right equivalent. And, like all of the sort of UX things that people invented over the past decade about smartphones. And, you know, and you could see Tesla doing this now, for example, for another big paradigm shift, which would be in self-driving cars, right? Like we've had about a century of a similar UX experience of what driving is, and kind of saying, well, okay, now actually cars are going to drive themselves much better than you can drive them. So, you know, the first generation, you can even see that in Teslas, right? Like the first few Teslas, the cockpit looks very much like a traditional car. It has the same, you know, more or less the same layout. And like the new stuff is barely anything there. It's like you're sitting at a bar, like one flat screen TV next to it. And It's changing, right? It's evolving. They're not trying to say, how do we recreate the old experience? You know, how do we pipe in the engine noise so that it sounds like there's a strong engine? These are all understandable reactions.
Yeah.
But ultimately, those are gimmicks. That's nostalgia. At some point, you just need to invent the new way of doing things. And a lot of those new ways aren't going to stick. They're not going to work out. You just have to experiment and see what works and what doesn't. And then in a couple of decades, you find yourself in a radically different set of experiences than you had before. Except I don't think it's going to take a couple of decades now because everything's accelerated. I think it's going to take like a year.
Yeah, COVID, the great accelerator.
Yeah.
So you mentioned how different this product is from some of the others that came before it and how you're really trying to invent and discover these new UIs and UXs. What are the new use cases for this product? I know what the use cases are for Zoom, but I'm curious to see what you think the use cases are for Mm-hmm.
Well, I think there's sort of three broad categories. Zoom is the first one. The video meeting is one of the use cases. I don't think it's the most important one, but it's definitely a huge use case. And it's one that I think most people up to now, like that's the first one that they encounter us in is because someone is using it on a Zoom call or a Google Hangout call or something. So it's just, you know, making video meetings better that's I think the first one. And for every type of video meeting that you have. So basically all of the Zoom use cases are like one subset of what we would do. I think the second category is not meetings, it's in making content. So it's streaming, it's producing, it's making things. The original code name for this was Twitch for Olds. We want to make something for people who want to stream their PowerPoint slides rather than Fortnite. Making this for all the creators, because it's just a really great way to create stuff, not necessarily for a live meeting, but to make recordings. I think that one is probably, the long tail of that is probably bigger than video meetings. And then the third use case is when we said, well, actually, no, we don't want people to stream PowerPoint slides. We just want to finally rid the world of PowerPoint. So the third use case is the interactive recordings that you mentioned. The ability to record something, to make something that's a hybrid between a movie and a document, a movie and a PowerPoint deck. Right? So I can record a presentation in and send it around, and the audience can watch it like a movie, but they can also skip slides, they can flip pages, they can choose whether I appear and explain things or whether I just get out of the way and they can just view it as a PDF. So I think broadly speaking, those are the three architectural use cases, but all of them put together are going to make lots of real world things that you can do totally differently. What we're in the process of doing now is thinking, okay, well, how do you imagine education in this hybrid world? Instead of saying, all right, well, online education sucks, it's not as good as in person, but let's try to make it almost as good. What if we said, okay, that doesn't make any sense. How do we make it ridiculously better than it ever was in person, using new capabilities? So what is the future of teaching a class that is better than it ever was before? And it's some combination of in-person and online and live and pre-recorded and interactive and seamlessly transitioning between interactive, pre-recorded, and live, and so on. And then we can say, okay, well, what's the future of performance, of sales, of healthcare? If we're doing telemedicine, what should that be like? Surely there's ways that we can have much more effective healthcare than what we used to have to do, which is in-person show up at a doctor through some kind of hybrid combination of sometimes it's in person for things that need to be done in person, sometimes it's online, but when it's online, sometimes it's interactive and asynchronous and self-help, and sometimes it's live talking to a person, and then the video and dynamic objects and forms can be integrated into the same display. So we're kind of going through one use case at a time and trying to reinvent what these are going to be like over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think the education use case is fascinating. I know a few people who work in schools and they're adopting technology at a rate they never have before, of course, but it'll be fascinating to see how that all plays out. You mentioned all of the different use cases. What kind of users are you looking to bring on to actually fill out some of these use cases, at least while you're here in beta in August 2020?
Yeah. I mean, so in the beta, we're pretty clear about what our goal is. So we're not looking for any kind of, we're not looking for extra hype or publicity. We're not trying to increase the number of people using it. We're not in beta as a marketing thing. We're not trying to generate FOMO or something. The purpose of the beta period is to make a high quality product. And we're very serious about that. So what we want is, we want people who can be most helped, can be most impacted by having or a product, some version of our product in their lives. So we're looking for people whose some important thing in their life can be made better by using the product. Their job or their art or their performance or their teaching or something important to them can be made better. And then we want to work with these people pretty carefully to actually just figure out, okay, how do we make the product as impactful as possible for them, for their use cases? While we're in the beta, it's really about trying to get people that we would make a difference for, and then really listening and understanding and modifying a product to optimize that. And then when we are pretty confident that, okay, we've got something, we've got a product that actually has high impact for at least somebody, for some people, okay, well then we can release it as a commercial product. We have current plan is to do that in sometime in the fall, and then we'll enter the phase where we're trying to grow or scale or whatever. But we're not yet in the scale phase, we're in the impact phase.
Where can our listeners go to try out the product?
So mmhmm.app, and you can sign up for the beta. There's also, like you said, there's a bunch of videos of us, you know, demoing it and other people. All of the videos that we make are kind of live. So if you've seen any of my demo videos, like that's just me in one take using the product. There's no trickery. So if you see me doing it on video, it's how it works. And you can sign up to the list, and we're inviting new people every day.
Yeah, there's some fantastic experiments all over Twitter too. I saw.
Yeah, you can see other people using it and having fun, which is really great.
Yeah, it is. It is really great. I'm curious, as a product-centric company that's only 3 or 5 months old at this point.
Two. Wait, we got started in May, end of May. So yeah, maybe 3 months.
Wow,
it's kind of gone fast.
Wow, so that means you pretty much raised your round before you really got started.
Yeah, the seed round went fast. It only took a few days.
Yeah. We can touch on that later. But I am really curious, you know, with a product-centric company that's this early, how do you decide what features to prioritize? How do you even decide what to allow yourselves and your team to go after?
I think there's sort of two two ways to look at that. If we were using the product right now, I could show all sorts of graphs about how we think about this. But basically, this one question is, how many decisions are you making based on just your intuition versus how many are more data-driven based on, you know, user feedback and research and that kind of stuff? And you can kind of chart out through the life of a tech company, what percentage of the decisions are made by, you know, just by feel, by intuition versus by data. And I really believe strongly that in the beginning, it's almost entirely intuition. And as the company matures, then it gets to be much more data driven until everyone complains that it's too data driven and you sort of lost the creative spark. And then, you know, you flip some tables over and you go back to intuition for a while. And then you sort of oscillate between those two. But early on, there is really no data. It's really up to us. It's up to the product designers to just decide what feels right, which is a very subjective thing. And it just is why you just have to have, you know, we're lucky enough to have very, very good people. Some of us have launched multiple products that have made it to hundreds of millions of people already. So we have a little bit of kind of instinct about it, but just know that we're just going to make decisions based on what feels right. We're going to get something wrong. We have to measure everything, but the results of the measurement is going to come later. Like that's in a few months when we actually start saying, okay, well, what was right? What was wrong? Oh man, we really thought this was a good idea, but it turned out no one understands it. And that's really the product design process. So we're at a stage right now where during the beta, the goal is to put things in the world that we think are the right things and then listen and watch people as they use it and get the feedback so that we can actually decide which of our intuitions was right or which of them were wrong. And then we have some time to make some adjustments. So we're kind of right in that phase now where we are starting to make adjustments based on, okay, well, we had some hypotheses and some of these were obviously right and some of these were obviously wrong. So we're going to change it. Hmm. So that's kind of one framework, right? It's like the intuition versus data framework.
Yeah. And
we're solidly on the intuition side for now, but that'll be radically different in 6 months.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your stellar product team there. How closely tied is that team to All Turtles? Is it the exact same team or is this a spin out of All Turtles?
Yeah, so mm-hmm, is an All Turtles company. So the first 20 or so people on it are all All Turtles people, All Turtles employees. So it's the team that we were lucky enough to be able to assemble. And then our first new people, we just started hiring in the past couple of weeks. So now we've got people that we're hiring that are new. But yeah, it's a spin out. So this is how All Turtles work. Is we work on a bunch of stuff. We have a team standing by that can do lots of things. And then as projects come along, if some of them deserve to be spun out and become more arms length, then we do that. We raise external capital. So is a spin out from All Turtles, which makes it an All Turtles company.
Gotcha. So All Turtles is a product design firm that you founded after Evernote, really to work on interesting products, spin things out, work with founders that you like.
Yeah, it's a product studio that I co-founded with John and Jessica. And the idea is just to make, the hope is that we can make worthwhile products for the world with as little bullshit as possible, as little of the inefficiencies that usually go along with the kind of the Silicon Valley treadmill. And yeah, I think we've got 8 or so kind of projects underway. Some of them like or before our previous spin out was called Spot. It's an AI for workplace harassment and discrimination. So some of those things are, we just come up with them internally as ideas and then we make them and then we spit them out. Others like Carrot Utility, which actually just announced raising their B round. Tell Us, which also just raised money. Those are more startups that we just work closely with and do a bunch of stuff together with. But they're independent startups to begin with. And sometimes we work with large corporate partners. So we have partnerships with big companies where we're making like virtual joint ventures together. So it's a product studio. Try to make it as much no nonsense as possible. And mm-hmm is our second original product spin out from it.
And you decided to, are you still working on some of the other projects too? Or are you deciding to go full time on mm-hmm?
So I'm running both companies right now. So I'm the CEO of All Turtles and I'm trying to do that as well as possible. You know, we'll see how that goes. It's a very different kind of job. Mm-hmm is very much one specific product. It's a small team. So there, basically what I'm doing is just kind of setting the product direction and being pretty hands-on with some of the design things and then just kind of standing back and letting the designers and the engineers and the marketing people who are much better than I am handle all of that stuff. And then a lot of the work for mm-hmm is done at All Turtles. For example, all of the illustration, the branding, legal stuff, that's all the All Turtles people doing. So I'm running both and just have to see how that goes over the next months and years.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It also brings me back to a question that I have to ask. How did you come up with the name Mm-hmm, and why Mm-hmm?
That's a pretty common question. We wanted an unusual name. We wanted a name that's unusual enough that it's hard to put it next to anything else in your head. It sort of forces you to make a new box in your head to keep it in. And yeah, there's all sorts of jokey reasons for it and a couple of serious reasons for it. But naming products is a whole giant philosophy. So there's a video specifically about why we named it that, which I'm happy to share.
So you have a whole philosophy about how you name your products?
Yeah, I have a philosophy about everything. It's really tedious how many philosophies I have. Naming products is one of many things that I could philosophize about tediously.
Any tips on naming products for any product engineers in the audience?
Well, I mean, the first one is just take it seriously. Like, naming is a type of design that is an important part of design. And, you know, man, so many tips. I guess if you want to be serious about it, probably where I would start is Google the Igor naming guide. There's a naming firm called Igor, which publishes this naming guide. It's a PDF that you can just get. It's free. Igor naming guide. And it's really good. And we don't follow it. I mean, naming things for 25 years. But it's really, really, really good to have the shared vocabulary and to understand it. So I would say, if you really haven't thought about naming in a systemic way, the first thing I would do is get the Igor naming guide, Google for it, download it, read it. It'll kind of blow your brain with how much stuff there is to it and how to think about it and give you all sorts of both artistic and scientific structures for considering it. So I would do that first and then decide how you're going to violate all of the rules that they put in place. But understand them first.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I will have to check that out for the next time I'm naming something, like a podcast. If only I'd known that a month ago.
This is a good name. So what you have is you've got a functional name in this. So one of the things that the Igor naming guide will tell you is that there's four different types of names. Yours is functional. But among functional names, the categories aren't good or bad. There are good functional names and bad functional names and so on. You've got a functional name, although it's also a little bit evocative. And I think it's a good combination. But yeah, check out the guide. It's cool.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that. So I'd also love to touch on the business model a little bit. So I know Evernote, which you scaled from inception up through raising, I think, over 200 million. That was a freemium model.
400 million.
400 million. Mm-hmm. Feels like it would be freemium as well. What's the business model going to look like here?
So similar to Evernote. Freemium. It's apparently the only business model I know. It'll be stuff for free. We want people to be able to use it for free and to get a lot of value because we really want everyone using it. And then there'll be stuff that you pay for, which hopefully makes it better, more delightful. We're just now, literally like this week and next week, figuring out kind of what's what. In the beta, everything is free. So we're going to be figuring out what you should pay for and how much. And then there'll be, at some point, probably not right away at launch, but at some point within a few months, we'll have an enterprise version for organizations, for companies that do things that companies want, tons of stats and access control and things like that. We have a really important philosophy here as well. Everything that we do at Old Turtles, there's only one business model that's allowed: direct revenue. So freemium is a sort of direct revenue. But the fact that it's freemium versus just paid, like, that's not really what's important. What's important is that it's direct revenue. So the only way that we are allowed to make money is by people or companies paying us to use our product. That's it. There can never be any advertising, any selling of your data for something. We make money by selling products that people want to pay money for. And that's just true of everything. It's true of all of the projects we do, because I think once you allow for indirect revenue models, it just causes all sorts of design problems and potentially ethical problems. And it's a whole thing that we want to avoid. So we really didn't have to think too hard about the business model. The business model, like every business model we've ever worked on, is we make something cool that people don't mind spending money on. And then we ask them to spend that money.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting that you hold that line. What's the growth strategy look like? So there's already a ton of hype, as we mentioned, on Twitter around the closed beta right now. But I'm curious, you know, once you launch out of beta, probably in the fall, what's that going to look like? How are you going to scale?
So I think strategy is too generous a word for it. We have, you know, we have sketched out plans, and it's basically try to make a good product that has impact and then amplify around the edges how many people know about it to scale, but really just let it scale based on it having impact. This is a really important thing for me. My friend and my former partner at General Catalyst, Hemant, his first book is called Unscaled. And it's really good. We had him on a podcast. We did a whole series with Hemant on the Old Turtles podcast about Unscaled. And his main philosophy is that it used to be that a company had to scale before it could have impact, because so much was based on getting big enough. Basically, you have to get big before you could make a difference. Until you got big, you just didn't have the kind of economies of scale and reach and distribution and margins and number of people. So like, business is all about get to scale, get big, and then you can try to impact the world. And I think now that's flipped on its head. So this is kind of Hemant's hypothesis, which I totally agree with, is like, now you have to get to impact first. So first you start making a difference, and then you can get big, which I think is a really beautiful and elegant way of thinking about it. And, you know, there's a lot more to it than that, but that's basically what it comes down to. So the idea is, I have never believed in growth hacking and really anything other than impact. How do we get to a point where we know that our product is making a positive impact on somebody? And then scaling is basically saying, okay, well, now we have a positive impact on these 10 people. How do we make it 1,000 people? And then how do we make it 1,000,000 people? And then how do we make it 1,000,000,000 people? But you always grow from the impact first. So that's the philosophy of it. I warned you, I have many tedious philosophies.
You do. But that's a really good one. I mean, it sounds like a playbook for how to build products that customers love, which Evernote, it must be one of the most beloved products I've ever heard of.
Well, and it was the same thing. Like, how do we scale it? I mean, there were no tricks. We didn't have a growth team for a long time, not for many years. We made something that people loved because it had an impact. And then we amplified those stories. And then because it was high impact, it was easy to get partners to distribute us. So we had all sorts of channel distribution plays, which I think we'll have again. But we got a lot of publicity and support and distribution from Apple, Google, Microsoft, Samsung, Sony, Fujitsu, big telephone carriers. This is all for Evernote. You know, I think we'll be rerunning that playbook, right? Make something that people want to use and distribute and partner with, and then just be pretty open-minded about how we do that. But it's a little premature. First, we need to get the impact.
Yeah, but that explains the focus on interesting use cases and specific people who can do things that they love with it at this point in the beta.
That's always the most important thing. How do we know? How do we get to the point where we deserve to get big? And until we get to that point, there's no getting big. Mm-hmm. But once we deserve it, how do we know that we deserve it? Like, can we actually point to like real human beings who are using it, who for whom it makes an important difference? And if we can, then okay, then that's a good first step. And then we just get those people to talk. It all sort of starts snowballing from there. But first we have to get to that. We know that we have a good product that's making life better for someone. Mm.
At this stage, you mentioned this a little bit earlier when we were talking about the product design and how you choose what to design and what not to, and what's based on feel and what's data driven. But at this stage, what do you track as far as metrics as a CEO?
We track everything. So I'm a data nerd. So we have a lot of instrumentation. That's different from asking what's important, because we track things. It doesn't necessarily mean that everything is equally important at the same time. There's a framework that we have that I call the state machine. If you Google my name and state machine, there's like a bunch of videos of me kind of going over it in various startup conferences or whatever. But we have a framework that basically tries to accurately depict the state of every single person in the world and how they interact with our product or don't interact with our product. And every transitional state is something that we measure. And then we decide, okay, which ones are we trying to increase or decrease in any particular month? And then we have groups of people working on each one. So the first step is just to measure this in a very specific way. And then based on what the early results are, you decide which is most important to optimize. So very often for startups, for new startups, for new products, very often the first thing that you need to optimize for is the bounce rate, which is the number of people who experience your product once and then don't keep using it. They just bounce away right away. Mm-hmm. Like that. That is usually the most important early thing to figure out. We don't have enough data yet for that. We only have a couple of weeks of data, so we just literally can't take the cohorts yet. But I suspect that'll be true for us as well, that there'll be a large number of people that they try it, but then for whatever reason, the expectation mismatch or whatever, they just like don't stick around. And so the first step is usually to really fix that, is to optimize for that, so that you're not losing most of the people like right away. They just bounce off. Once you have that in decent shape, then you start optimizing for everything else. But yeah, there's a whole structure for it.
Yeah.
Yet another
philosophy.
Long and detailed philosophy with, you know, graphs and numbers about this one.
Yeah. I'm curious, what's most important right now? And what will be most important in a year from now, short, midterm, long-term goals?
So the most important thing in terms of measurement of progress is going to be consistent. So the most important thing is, imagine that we have and I think this is true for almost every product, so this is pretty generalizable, that there are some group of people that are getting a lot of value from your product, right? And so the first question is, how do you know that? How do you measure that? So I think every company needs to answer that and needs to answer it pretty quickly. So how do you know that these are people that are actually getting high value? So step one is being able to point to these people and be like, this person, this person, this person.
How do you measure those people?
Well, at a very early stage, when you're literally just in beta, you just talk to them.
Ah.
So you're only looking for like a few dozen. Mm-hmm. And then you look at how those few dozen behave and you try to make behavioral signals to try to predict how many there really are based on the ones that you've talked to. So that when you have, you know, hundreds or thousands, it's easier to approximate. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to start by approximating, you just start by actually talking to them. So first you do that. Then the second thing is you need to have a business model where the people who are getting the most value from you are also the people from whom you are getting the most money or the most value. You need to have this alignment where the customers who are your best customers, meaning they love you the most and they get the most value out of you, are also the ones that your company is benefiting from. And lots of companies don't have this, right? Lots of companies have like the company, the people who get the most value out of them are actually like not the most useful customers. This is all about revenue models. And this is why we say it's direct revenue only. That tends to smooth that thing out. Mm. So then once you're at a point where you know how to measure how many people are getting a lot of value from you, and you've confirmed that you're also getting value from those people, then it's really about how quickly and consistently does that cohort grow? So are you growing that group of people by, you know, 20% month over month or 10% or -3%? How many of them are sticking around? How many of them are leaving? How many new people are going into just that high value, high use cohort? Everything else doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter like how many downloads you have, or MAUs over DAUs. That's all nonsense. Mm-hmm. How do you know who's actually getting, who are you having impact on? And is that group growing? And so that's basically what all of the state machine philosophy comes down to. There's just ways of measuring that. So we're in the early stages of that, but that's what we're going to do. In terms of like business priority, right now it's probably hiring. We have about a dozen job recs open. Just go to mm-hmm.app or all-turtles.com and just look at jobs if you're interested in joining the team. And, you know, hiring, like building the team is always the hardest thing at kind of every stage. In the beginning, it's about hiring. Towards the middle, it's more about like retention and career development. Right now, we're very much in interviewing as many people as possible and trying to make good, you know, good hiring decisions mode.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, for our listeners, it does look like you have a ton of open roles. Any key ones that are really top of mind for you to fill at the moment?
Well, who knows what we've filled and what we haven't by the time this airs, but also like a lot of the roles on there, we're looking for more than one person. So even if we filled something, we're probably going to keep some things up. I am really anxious until we get the right head of customer support. So one of the key roles for me right now, we have a really good customer support team, but at this point we don't have a person who's going to run it and scale it. You know, customer support for this kind of product is always going to be your biggest team. So I think getting great customer support is really important. And that's also what is going to let, you know, me and Seth and other people give us back a bunch of time. When there is someone who is much better at customer support than I am, then I can stop doing customer support, which would be great. I'm never actually going to stop it. That's an endless thing forever, but good to have that team. So that's probably top of mind. We're also looking for a council. So we really want someone to help us think through and implement what kinds of things do we want? What kinds of things do we not want? How do we, you know, how do we make sure of that? And we are constantly shorthanded on engineering and design resources. So those are evergreen. Engineering and design roles are always high priority. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if you or if any of your listeners know someone who would be an amazing person at building and leading a customer support team or doing community management, we'd definitely love to see more applications.
Yeah, absolutely. How else can our listeners help?
Well, I think the most important thing right now is high quality use cases. Try out the beta. And if you have something that you think that like, oh, well, if we only made this change, it could really have a high impact on my life. That's what we want to hear about. We want to hear about what could we do specifically to make the product something that would cause it to have a higher impact on your life over the next few weeks. That is what the beta is for us. So I'm sure you have lots of listeners with lots of ideas about what they want to do, companies they want to start, products they want to build. If you have specific ideas about what we could do to make that better, the most useful thing for us is to get them to use the product and to hear those ideas and work with us to make those changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listeners, you've heard it from Phil, and you can reach out to us directly at JustRaise and we'll pass it along, or reach out directly to So the last thing I really wanted to talk to you about was the venture race. So you just raised 4.5 million from Sequoia.
think it was like 4.6 or 4.7 or something. Yeah, it doesn't matter, but yeah, something in that neighborhood.
I was going to say a few months after starting the company, but it sounds like actually a few months before starting the company.
No, it was right at. So I think we did it in June. We started the company in May. We closed the seed round in June. So yeah,
Gotcha.
like a couple of weeks after.
So at Evernote, you raised over 400 million, including at least 70 million from Sequoia. When you have that kind of relationship with a fund, do you do a pitch, or I'm curious how the raise came together?
Well, okay. So, I think the first thing is raising money is a really, it's chaotic and kind of unpredictable, right? And so I've been fundraising. I realized this actually a few months ago. I had this like a moment of epiphany where I realized that like, man, I do not like fundraising. I just don't like it. I don't enjoy the process of fundraising. And yet I have been raising money for some company every single year, nonstop for the past 27 years. So for the past 27 years, there has never been a year where I was not raising money. And I had this realization, like, man, like what set of unfortunate life decisions have put me in this place where the one thing that I've like acknowledged to myself I just don't like doing is something that I've literally been doing nonstop for 27 years. And I've never considered successful fundraising as an accomplishment. Getting someone to invest in you is not really an achievement. It's kind of an obligation. It's like now you have more people to not disappoint. Part of the whole like Silicon Valley mentality that really celebrates fundraising is something that I've never been fully comfortable with because I don't think it's a big achievement. I think it's an obligation. I feel honored and gratified that people want to back us, and I feel a great sense of responsibility to do the right thing by those people and by everyone else, by employees, by community, by everyone that's a stakeholder. And I've been raising money for 27 years, and sometimes it goes really, really fast, and sometimes it takes forever. Like I literally right before the fundraise, we were raising for All Turtles itself and for a couple of other projects, and some of those took like a year and a half of like crawling through glass to do. So it's kind of random, and it's often difficult, and I don't think that fast fundraisers are deserving of celebration any more so, in fact, maybe less so than the ones that took a long time and finally got done. So I've had both kinds. So yeah, was the fastest fundraise I've ever been involved with in my 27 years. It took a few days. I think that's because the timing is so good. I don't think we can say we have good product market fit because the product is still in early beta, so it's too early to judge, but I think it's obvious that we have great product market timing. So, the time worked out. Literally every single investor I talked to was looking for something, and I didn't have a single meeting pitching that people weren't laughing. Every single meeting resulted in people wanting to put money in. I'd never seen anything like it before, but again, it's because of the time that we were in and this idea. I don't think there was much else to it than that. So this one happened to be really fast and kind of fun. Others have taken a lot more. You kind of have to take both.
Yeah. Did you start building the product before COVID or post-COVID? Because you've built an incredible number of features in a really short amount of time.
Yeah, we started building it post-COVID. So we started working on it in May, I think. It was already a couple of months into lockdown. Yeah, it went fast. Now, I and a bunch of other people have been thinking about it for a while, for decades potentially. How to make meetings more productive. A lot of this is stuff that we've been obsessed about since Evernote days. On the one hand, we definitely didn't start typing code into a computer about this until a couple of months after the lockdown. On the other hand, this was definitely an area, a field that we've been obsessed with for a while. We were lucky enough to have a team in place with the right mindset and the right ability, and so we could just execute on it. But yeah, it's come phenomenally fast. It's a really good team. Like I am amazed by the level of execution that we've been able to do so far.
Congratulations on everything you've built so far.
Thank you. It's premature right now, but I think we're off to a good start.
From the 27 years of fundraising that you've done, any tips for founders who are out fundraising right now for their companies?
I think fundraising is really hard, but it's the easiest part of running a startup by far. So as hard as you think this current phase is, it's literally the easiest thing you're going to have to do. So if you're ready to kind of give up now because fundraising is not going well, like probably should just give up because it ain't going to get easier even after you raise money.
That is tough advice.
Yeah, because think about it, right? The great thing about fundraising, unpleasant as it is you have a clear success function, right? You know what you need to do. And if you did it, you've succeeded. Your success function is like, are there a few million dollars in my bank account? And as soon as there are, you're like, that was successful. And literally almost at no other time in the future of your company will you have that much clarity on what success feels like. And so the rest of it is much harder. So I would say that, you know, fundraising is, there's all sorts of art and science to it, but ultimately, as painful as it is, and I know how painful it is, it's actually the easiest part of running a company, which is kind of a long way of saying that unless your company is about righting some fundamental injustice in the world, unless you have a really clear idea of why you're doing this, and you really want to spend the rest of your life working on it, I don't see why you would do it. I don't see why you would start a company. Because like it starts hard and then it gets harder. And your chances of success are very far from guaranteed. So the only plausible reason I could think of for putting yourself through this is because you can't not do it. You're working on something that is so fundamental to what you want to exist in the world that doesn't matter how hard it is, you're just going to do it anyway.
Well, I know a few founders who do, more than a few founders who do fall into that last case. So
yeah.
I guess that's
yeah, many of us.
Yeah.
In terms of fundraising specifically, I would say that the number one piece of advice that I give to founders when I'm helping them fundraise, and which I remind myself of when I'm having a difficult fundraise, is it doesn't matter how many people say no, right? That's irrelevant. It does not matter how many people say no. As soon as you get a no, good, you move on. It doesn't matter. It only matters that a small number of people say yes. So the amount of no's is irrelevant. All you're looking for is one yes.
That's true. It would be beneficial for people to think of it that way, in that you could ask every VC on the planet, you only actually need one, and the no's don't matter at all.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Yeah, the no's don't accumulate. They shouldn't take this psychic toll on you. The no's are literally meaningless. You know, if everyone is saying no for the same reason, then, you know, you may want to pay attention, or you may not, whatever. Usually reasons VCs give you for saying no's are not super important. Just whatever is the easiest thing to say. You need one yes, you can deal with an unlimited number of no's. So, you know, those odds are pretty good if you look at it that way.
That does bring up some of the advice that you gave a little bit earlier. So when's the next round?
Probably pretty soon. You know, our original plan was we'd raise the seed round and then we would figure out sometime in Q1, you know, February-ish, about whether or not we were onto something. And then if we were, we'd start to raise the A round in February or March or something like that. So that was the plan, but I think February is going to come early.
Gotcha. Okay. The last question that I have for all the founders on the podcast is, what's your vision for Where do you see it being in 10 or 15 years?
Well, I have a vision for where I want the world to be in 10 or 15 years. And the short answer to what is I wanted to push the world further in that direction and not away from it. So I want to contribute to moving the world in the direction that I wanted to move to in this very specific way. We call it IRL plus, so better than in real life. So we think that we can make experiences. We can basically start reimagining everything that we do. And instead of trying to duplicate how it used to function in the before times, we have to say, well, how do we make it? What is the best that we can do with it, given new technology, new opportunities? And very often when we do that, we get a world that is just fundamentally better than the previous one. So it's IRL plus, better than real life. And that's what we want to do. So we want to play a major role reinventing important aspects of the world so that they are better than they were before the pandemic, before COVID. They are fairer, they're more accessible, they're more fun, they're more delightful, they're higher quality, they're better results. One use case at a time. How do we do that for medicine? How do we do that for education? How do we do that for comedy? How do we do that for everything? And I think the world right now is in this very, very, very dramatic inflection period. It is never going to be the same as it used to be. It's going to be different, but we want that different to be better. And we want to help make it so.
Well, that's a fantastic vision for the company. And I'm looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Thank you. Me too.